Hello and welcome to this week's Standing with Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support Europe, and this week I'm talking to Claudia Bonomini, who is the Policy and Advocacy Officer for JRS Europe. JRS Europe is the Jesuit Refugee Service, an organisation that accompanies, serves and advocates for refugees worldwide, and you're currently based in Brussels, is that right, Claudia?
That's right. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for joining us. And the reason that we got in touch was because you'd written an article a little while ago about the 20th of March deal between the EU and Turkey, 2016.
Exactly, yes. Yes.
And we arrived about 2 weeks after that deal was put in place, and so saw the fallout and aftermath and implementation of that in Greece. But that's at a very local level. I'd be really interested to have a chat with you about that policy and how well it's worked, what's worked and what hasn't worked.
Yes, well, so this year we arrived at the second year of the existence of this EU-Turkey deal. It's so-called EU-Turkey deal. Officially, maybe it should be called the EU-Turkey statement, because that what actually was. It was a statement by politicians deciding certain things. It came into existence 2 years ago, and it was a moment in which Europe in general was faced with a quite large amount of arrivals at the borders, especially at the time at the Greek border, but also at the Italian border. So let's say the year before, I would say 2014-15, was more Italy in the picture, and then at that moment in 2016, it was more the biggest arrivals were happening in Greece. And what we saw at the time was, I would say, a little bit of a panic reaction, really, from the European Union states in general. It's true, I think we have to be honest, and it's true that there was a substantial increase in the arrivals of people, of asylum seekers, people seeking protection in Europe. But okay, I think numbers can still be put in, should be put in them in the more broader world context. So there were big numbers, but they were not as big as in some other regions of the world. And even, I think, even if they were big, Europe could have probably dealt with this situation in a completely different way, in a more organized way. Instead, the reaction was a very much of a panic reaction. Of course, there was a general feeling also of not knowing what would be the solution for this situation. The public opinion was also shocked by the fact that a lot of people were also losing their lives at sea, in particular at the time. So instead of saying, okay, well, maybe we should find a way to help these people reaching Europe in a way that is not that dangerous and they don't lose their lives in the process, the European Union decided to go for, oh, the solution will be to prevent people from coming in the first place. And so I think this is also something that is a little bit, really wicked in this deal, is that it was also presented and is still presented by many policymakers as a life-saving agreement. What was the deal about? European states agreed with Turkey that Turkey would readmit back, so would take back everyone arriving irregularly from Turkey to the Greek islands, starting from the 18th of March. Well, probably in the practice was a week later, but in any case, starting from this deal. And in exchange, the European Union would resettle some people from Turkey, namely Syrians. So the deal was saying, okay, for every Syrian that was sent back, according to the in application of this deal, from the Greek islands to Turkey, another Syrian that was in Turkey at the moment would be resettled, so would get the chance to fly, to be safely brought to a European Union member state to apply for asylum, and most probably get it because of the situation in Syria. Mm. So the idea was, okay, by doing this, people at some point will understand, okay, there is no point in trying to cross the sea to go to Greece, because then Greece will send us back anyway to Turkey.
That didn't happen, did it?
Well, that, yes and no. So it's true that the arrivals decreased a lot. It's not really true that people that arrive, because arrivals decrease, but are still happening. And actually, I think in the last months, they are again increasing.
I think last year, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think last year was about 60,000
I don't know the figures, to be honest, by heart, but it's possible. It's very possible. But the year before, we were talking of much. We were talking at some point about 3,000 people a day that would arrive from Turkey. So that really changed dramatically after, shortly after the application of the EU Turkey statement. Because it's true that there was the element of the deterrence helped, but also the fact Turkish authority were also patrolling. So let's say the Turkish authority were also more actively preventing departures. So that was also part of this political agreement, is that also Turkey would stop people from leaving, would be more careful in controlling their borders towards Europe. And what didn't happen, or not in any case in the scale that was thought it would happen, was the return of people that actually arrived to Greece. And this was clear from the very beginning, and everyone said this will not work, for the simple reason that if people arrive and ask for asylum, the European legislation gives them the right to do it and it prevents states to send them back anywhere before they actually looked into this asylum application. What happened, and what many states were trying to and still are trying to argue, is that, well, okay, we're not sending these people back. So let's say it's a Syrian person. We're not sending this Syrian person back to Syria, which would be prohibited, which is prohibited by the Refugee Convention and which be in violation of the right of asylum. But we're sending this person back to Turkey, and Turkey is a safe country. So the whole idea of this behind this statement was that Turkey is a safe country for refugees. And this, of course, can be also questioned, and it was questioned a lot. And also, let me come back to the situation on arrival on the Greek island. So the people would arrive, and then at that stage, most of them would apply for asylum. And then when they did, the Greek authorities had to look into that. And very often, they would find that it was not possible actually to send them back to Turkey. The Greek legislation was quickly changed to incorporate this concept of safe third country in the legislation, so to make it possible to actually say, have a sort of a preliminary examination of the application that would just stop by saying, okay, but how did you come to Greece? Oh, you crossed from Turkey. Okay, but Turkey is a safe country, so we send you back there and your claim will be further examined there. So this concept was put into the Greek legislation, yet even in this condition, the judges in Greece prevented in practice most of the transfers back to Turkey for, I would say, reasons that have to do with the safety of the country and the vulnerability of the people, but sometimes also for practical reason and the policy.
Reasons. My understanding was the court said that they weren't going to send anybody back to Turkey because it was dangerous for them.
The thing is that the asylum procedure is always individual, so the commissions and the judges, they look at the specific situation individually, and there is no general statement or jurisprudence that says that Turkey is not safe for anybody. But in reality, in many situations, it was just that for the specific situation, for the vulnerability of the people, for the case it was still not safe to send them back to Turkey. And the other reason I was talking about the practical part is also that the procedures in Greece at this moment is still taking very long time. So in some cases, it's the idea that was behind like a quick, okay, people arrive and we send them back, it didn't work for legal reasons, but also for very practical reasons, because, it just doesn't go that quickly. If you apply for asylum, then you start a procedure and then a certain steps have to be taken. So in the practice, did this statement work? Well, yes and no, it worked in a way because the arrivals decreased. But then also in this point, you can question, because do we have to celebrate the fact that people are not able to leave Turkey anymore? I think we can really question that, because it's quite known that the situation in Turkey is far from being safe for many refugees, maybe for some. It's true that in Turkey there is no open conflict and there are no bombs falling on people's head like it's the case in Syria. But then we also know that there are massive problems of child labor. For example, there are enough reports about Syrian children being forced into child labor. There are enough reports also about other violations of rights, the access to the labor market. But then it's true that from a political perspective and from a lot of the perspective of many policymakers in Europe, this is not seen as a reason to apply for protection in Europe. They say, but this is not a protection issue. This is is an economic reason. And then they kind of go on elaborating on this division between the refugee who needs protection and the economic migrant who shouldn't come for some reason to Europe. And they, in a way, the Syrian refugee in Turkey somehow transforms into an economic migrant as soon as he wants to come to Europe. And this is really wrong, because the people will not stop moving until they actually find conditions in which they feel protected. And protection is much more than just a piece of paper. Protection is also the possibility of really taking up one's life again that was interrupted because of conflict or because of persecution. And you can, if you don't find those conditions in a country, then you also try, you move on until you find a place where you have them, which is also not Greece, by the way. Many people are trying to also move away from Greece for a very similar reason.
Yeah, we've heard the story of child labour over and over again from families that are in Greece. And a very typical story is that they will have spent some time in Syria until it became unbearable and life-threatening. They then made this treacherous journey into Turkey, and many of them will have tried to make a life in Turkey, but the working 6 days a week, the paying everything just to have a roof over their heads, the kids having to be in child labour, the sense of discrimination against them has then compelled them to move on. As we all would do, it seems to me. Yeah. But like you say, they then get classed as economic migrants. But to me, it's still a kind of persecution in another form. And so there's that. And then the other thing as well is that, you know, in all the camps where we've worked, large proportions of them have been Kurdish. And although they're Syrian, I can't imagine that Kurdish ethnic group is going to get a great reception in Turkey.
For sure. Yeah, no. But again, the idea that Turkey is a safe country for refugees is very much questionable. And I think every civil society organization also did question that. For me, personally, what was very striking about this statement, if you had asked me 6 months earlier, because the idea is not new, no? It was hanging in the air for a while that the European policymaker might try to have some agreement with Turkey. And I think many, many people in the sector 6 months before would say, no, but really, this is so illegal. Like, there is no way that they will be able to just to legally justify this. And then 6 months later, it just happened.
Yeah.
Despite the criticism, despite the legal arguments that are there and still are there. And I think that was really and still is the most shocking thing, because actually the EU-Turkey deal, according to Europe, worked very well because arrivals decreased. And it worked so well that if they could, they would do more of these deals. One of the ideas was to replicate something similar with Libya. The only reason why that didn't happen yet is because there is not really a government in Libya where you can actually really do this kind of statement. And also, I want to hope, because the situation in Libya is also far, I mean, it's like at another level of unsafe. There is a conflict in the country, and then there are massive violations of human rights that are so clear that I want to hope this is also was holding policymakers a bit back. But it didn't prevent Italy to sign a memorandum of understanding with the Libyan recognized government in order to also prevent departures. So this is not framed as a statement. It's not framed as the EU-Turkey deal. It doesn't have this element of we send people back and then we resettle people, because that would be really even more difficult to legally justify the fact that we would send people back to Libya. But then what is the trick there? We trained the Libyan Coast Guard to prevent departures. So we are technically not sending people back, and we're not doing the so-called pushbacks that are illegal, but people don't arrive. So basically people are pulled back, but not by us, by the Libyan authorities, and then it's all right. But in the fact, is really the kind of mindset of the EU-Turkey deal is there as well. And I am recently, even Spain was calling for a EU-Morocco deal.
Yeah.
With the same idea, because they also in Spain there was also a smaller but still an increase of arrivals from Morocco, and then this was again like, oh, maybe it's an idea to have some sort of, and also because in that case Morocco is seen also as a good student and is receiving funding also from the European Union to improve their migration legislation a bit on the model of the European Union legislation, and so it should be rewarded somehow. That was a bit the reasoning also behind Spain statement. But so this is really the worrying element, that this is becoming, this Youth Turkey deal is becoming the blueprint for how the European Union deals with the arrival of protection seekers at its border. And it's really, really worrying.
It is worrying. And I mean, I think probably lots of us have seen the stories of the treatment of refugees or migrants in Libya who yeah. are now being forced to remain there because of that agreement that has been done with Italy, yeah. and living in those shocking conditions, and I mean very yeah. very dubious legally and morally. And I suppose coming back to the EU-Turkey deal, in whichever dimension you look at this, as a deal, like you say, it's a statement, but it ended up being the deal. Mm-hmm. Is that whether you look at it morally, legally, and you mentioned there that legally it's dubious as well, or even on a practical level, it seems to be a huge failure.
Yeah, I think the biggest failure is the moral one, absolutely. Because even if, let's say, even if it legally we can find ways to somehow justify, I don't see how, but even if, let's say, we change the law, because that's what sometimes policy makers do. If it's not legal, they change the law, then it becomes legal. Even if we practically can make it work, but really morally, I mean, Turkey, leaving aside whether Turkey is safe or not for refugees, Turkey is already hosting 3 million refugees from Syria only. And this is only the Syrians. There are also Afghani people there. There are also other nationalities that are Iraqi, exactly. So 3 million only Syrian. I mean, is it morally acceptable that Europe in general, like the European Union, one of the wealthiest region in the world, kind of agrees and finds it normal to externalize responsibility for protection of refugees to countries that are already actually taking much more than a fair share, I would say. I mean, we can say a lot of, we can criticize Turkey in many ways, and we should, but it's true that at the moment when the Syrian conflict started, Turkey left the border open. That changed in time, and it's not always, still not always the case. There is also talk about pushbacks at the Turkish border, but in the beginning, this was the attitude. They left the border open, and actually Europe even was encouraging this. It was saying, no, but this is a clear situation. This is a clear crisis there. It's a humanitarian crisis, and there is a need of protection, and the border should be open. But then the Turkish border should be open at the side of Syria, but should clearly be very close at the side of Europe, because people don't have to come over. So morally, I think there is something really fundamentally wrong in this way of reasoning, and this is really, again, is kind of this is becoming the way Europe look and think its policy when it comes to asylum and protection. It's resounding a lot, like this idea of let's send the help in the region, such as in Turkey, and then we do resettlement. So we invite, we manage the arrivals by actively inviting people through resettlement. Which is a good idea. I mean, we are all for resettlement, and it should be happening massively, actually. But it's not enough, and it will never be enough. And even if you do much more than this, probably some people will still find other way or need other ways to come. So I don't know. Even this manipulation of the use of resettlement is disturbing for me. Okay, we want also resettlement, but it doesn't mean that you block the borders and then you do resettlement. It should be and you know, you find ways also to welcome people that for some reason or another they still cross the border irregularly, and then you also invest massively then in other safe and legal pathways, be it resettlement, but then also family reunification, which is at the moment very strict often in many European countries, but that could be also a path for other refugees to arrive legally instead of taking dangerous routes, but also humanitarian visa. There are possibilities that are there, and there are underexplored, and instead all the attention goes on the arrivals at the borders and on having these arrivals decrease. And this is really the paradox, the morally wrong element in this whole story, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just to stick with the moral questions as well, I mean, one of the things that sickens me, especially, you know, dealing with these people in a, you know, face to face and knowing them as I do, yeah. is the extent to which they get used as pawns in a political game. Because, you know, that part of that statement as well was that we would give Turkey money to settle those people in Turkey, and we would also yeah. speed up negotiations and change some of the rules about their accession to the European Union. And then there's the, you know, Greece was there having to shoulder the burden because that's where the people were. And then the EU gave them quite a lot of money to process those. It's not quite clear where all that money's gone in Greece as well. I mean, I know it's an expensive operation, but, you know, we're still seeing people who are having to wait, you know, well over a year before they can get an interview for an asylum application.
Yeah, and also people who are forced to stay on the islands, because this is also part of this deal. Yeah. The fact Turkey would only take back people from the islands. So then Greece is keeping people on the islands, even though those islands are overcrowded, have been overcrowded for a long time already. And the reason why the people are not moved to the mainland is because otherwise they kind of lose the chance to eventually send them back to Turkey. And this is again, like, so we choose, Greece chooses under the pressure of the European Union, of course, to keep people in miserable situation, in inhuman conditions, in order to enforce policy, to make a point. And then this is really immoral. And I think you said it rightly, the blame is not on Greece, not only on Greece, because the rest of Europe is not really shouting out in outrage for the situation of people on the Greek islands. On the contrary, I hear a lot of silence around this question. And I think that is because as soon as other European countries would start asking Greece to move people on the mainland, the next question would also come, because, well, the Greek mainland is also what it is, and it's also not really equipped, and there are better reception facilities, but these are also not endless. So there, at some point, they would be overcrowded as well. And so the next question would be, okay, but this is actually a European issue, and why should Greece only receive all these people? Maybe we should try to share the responsibility for the reception of asylum seekers. And this was tried with the relocation from Greece and Italy to other European countries, and also failed miserably, mainly because of political will, because unfortunately it's the political atmosphere prevailing around Europe is one of not wanting people to come. With a few exceptions. I think the exception of Portugal, maybe even of Spain, that there was somehow a little bit more public and political will. But then it's also because, I think, it's probably also because in this country arrivals in general are quite low. So you can see a little bit of a trend in countries, especially northern European countries, where arrivals have been also higher, where there is a reaction like, okay, we don't want them anymore. We want to help somewhere far from us, but we don't want people to arrive here. And this is really a very worrying trend. To be positive, though, I must say that working in this field for a while, we also still see, we saw in the moment of the peak, let's say, of the arrivals, but we still see it. There are a lot of people that are welcoming refugees on a daily basis, and they are doing a lot of work, organizations like yours. But I think that they started, like so many organizations, so many grassroots organizations started in the last year, and that is also Europe. So when politicians are saying that their electorate doesn't want to have more refugees, I think we can also say, well, this is not completely true. There is enough people, luckily, in Europe that actually think we should take, it's our moral obligation and legal obligation to actually work and welcome these people. But it's true that these voices are always more quiet, and they shout less, so then they work more, and you don't hear them so much in the debate.
I'm glad that we started to talk a little bit more about the positive side, because however I look at the 20th of March statement and what's happened after that, it's very hard to be positive at all about it. It just seems like a huge failure. But I mean, looking forward, do you see any optimism, any cause for optimism, any green shoots?
Oh, no, I'm afraid I also don't see that much, because I don't know, this EU Turkey deal, if it worked for something, it was to make some situation disappear, not being visible anymore. Because it's not that people are not arriving anymore. People are arriving. Maybe they're less in numbers, but they still are arriving. Their journeys are possibly became even more difficult than they were. And there is this idea, okay, but it has worked. We don't have these arrivals anymore, so problem solved. But the problem, unfortunately, the emergency is not solved. And it's still there, and people are still suffering. If there is any reason to hope, I'm not sure really, because if I look around, I'm a very optimistic person in general, and I want to be positive, and my only hope is in really in the people I see, in the people I see, the many volunteers that I see that are working for GRS also around Europe, that are working for many other organizations, and there is a positive energy there. But somehow this is not reflecting in the political choices that then prevail. If I look at the elections, the recent elections we had elections in Italy, and the results were not really encouraging when it comes to this kind of issues. We had elections the last weekend in Hungary, and that was definitely not a good news for the issues we deal with. So I don't know. Next year we will have European elections, the European Parliament. So because at the European level there are several processes now going on in terms of legislation that were also actually initiated in 2015 and 16, like during this emergency moment. And as every legislative intervention that starts in an emergency moment, they were not really improving the situation. I think it's actually always very bad when people start changing legislation under the pressure of an emergency, because you don't see sharply when you're in an emergency, and you kind of tend to throw away some principles that you actually normally situation find very important. But even in this, so the European Commission had presented several proposals to revise the European legislation on asylum, and they were not positive. Even in this situation, the Parliament, the European Parliament, so the democratic elected institution of the European Union, came to some positions on this legislation that they were at least trying to save what could be saved. They're very often in all these files, there's still no decision, no final decision, because the European decision making is a bit of a complex thing. The Parliament needs to find an agreement with the Council, and the Council is where the member states are represented. And in this context, member states don't have one voice at this moment. They're very divided on many issues, so they are struggling in getting to final decisions on these files. But we could see, at least from an NGO perspective, we could see the Parliament as, in any case, I would say, an ally in this whole discussion, coming with more progressive positions. And I'm a little bit afraid that that might change as well.
Let's hold on to this idea that there's a grain of hope here, because I think, running humanitarian aid operation, it's really putting a sticking plaster over what is a much bigger political problem. I think the only way that we're going to get real positive change is if people engage with this, yes, and try and influence policymakers. And I see that on the JRS website, jrs.net, for people listening, you've got some campaigns. There's lots of information on there as well about how people can inform themselves and advocate on behalf of refugees. Great. Thank you, Claudia, for standing with refugees, and thank you to everyone listening. We talk to someone every week and make it available to download on Monday. You can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes. Download, find it on our website. Please tell us what you think. You can email me, paul@refugeesupport.eu. We're also on Facebook, Refugee Support Europe, Twitter, Instagram. And if you have any suggestions about who else we can talk to, please let us know. Thank you, Claudia.
My pleasure.